Committee on Judiciary, Wednesday, March 4th, 1986. Full committee.
Representative Phillips is, I believe, excused for the rest of the afternoon. Representative Burton is testifying on one of our other favorite issues down in the E&E Committee, talking about garbage, and expects to return here. He has a particular interest in 2021 and 2026, and he's asked that we delay for a few minutes consideration of those two measures until he has a chance to join us. So I'm going to respond to that request. We also, in subcommittee, just for other full committee members' information, we had some amendments and some issues on 2021 and 2026, which we really felt ought to be discussed at the full committee level. Members should be aware that both of those bills are bills which we had requested to have loaned to us, and this is the last day of the period in which we have the bills, and after today they'll go back to the E&E Committee with our recommendations, if any. So that's basically how we'll deal with 2021 and 2026. We'll hold those for a few minutes until Representative Burton is able to join us. So I'd like to proceed, if I may, Council, with the bills as they're listed for our work session this afternoon. We've got 2046. That came from Representative Burton's committee, I believe, or subcommittee, but I believe the issues are fairly easily addressed. Council, would you like to maybe just to introduce the bill for the full committee in our consideration?
House Bill 2086.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Hanlon.
Just a preliminary matter. Are we going to talk at all about this 1985 versus 1987 timeline today and the attachment on bills in and out?
If you'd like to add that to our agenda, that would be fine. This was information which was distributed to the meeting of committee chairs in the speaker's office, and I thought I would make a copy for you so you can kind of understand the instructions and the information that's been shared with us. I believe, as has been the case in the past, because of the number of bills that we get, there has been a kind of a, at least practice has established an exception for Judiciary Committee to some of these guidelines. Your comments to me would be helpful, and with those comments, I'd be glad to approach the leadership and discuss an understanding which recognizes that we may not be necessarily bound by as strictly as other committees just because of the nature of the workflow.
Mr. Chairman, I just asked that because I had inquiries from other members of the committee, and Representative Bellamy might have a question. I don't know.
Sure. As you'll note, as of this report, last week we had 213 bills in committee, and we reported out two for a percent of 0.93% acted on. our percentage is going to come up a little bit this week, I think. But you should also know that, according to the speaker, as of yesterday afternoon, there were 400 bills still to be printed, and some of those probably will come our way also.
Mr. Chair.
We get a handful every day.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the speaker's philosophy on efficiency of the process, but as a scorecard of percentage of bills acted on, I think that's irrelevant to the product of either this body or the Senate. And if 99% of the bills are hypothetically bad, then 99% of the bills shouldn't go anywhere.
The record will show the chair is nodding affirmatively. Were there other questions, kind of a preliminary nature or related to our agenda before we proceed? And again, one of the reasons I asked that this be shared was just if you folks have any comments you'd like to share with me or with the leadership, feel free. And I would certainly invite your advice from any member in terms of suggestions for how we proceed. I've tried, I think, to put folks on notice that because of the workload and because of the leadership's desire to conclude our work as expeditiously as possible, we need to be prepared for evening hearings as well during the next couple months. So, without further ado, may we proceed with 2086. Mr. Taylor?
This is a bill that was filed at the request of the Corrections Division and it relates to the terms of the Corrections Industry Board. Currently, all nine members are appointed at the same time. This would result in a board turnover at the same time without any consistency. Thus, the corrections have asked that the board's terms be staggered so that one-third will be appointed each year. There are currently three groups from which members are taken: labor, industry, and the general public. So as a result, one from each of those groups would be taken. There is no fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay. I think as one who served on that subcommittee, it's fair also to say that though it wasn't addressed within the four corners of the bill, we were able to get some background information which was helpful to us in terms of sort of the work plan of the prison industries people. They have reviewed their work plan very carefully with the Ways and Means Committee and the Emergency Board as part of the Corrections Division budget, and we felt pretty good about just some of the progress they've made over the past year and some of their plans for the future, including expanding the opportunities for work to be performed by inmates, as well as deal with new correctional facilities that are planned and expansion of those facilities. Is there further discussion or comment or any questions? Representative Miller?
Counselor, could you, who makes the appointment of these directors?
I believe it's the governor.
Is there any discussion whether or not the establishment of staggered terms runs contrary to maybe what has become a policy of the governor to sack all kinds of boards and commissions at one time?
There was no discussion concerning that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Representative Hanlon?
I'll move House Bill 2086 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2086 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Brown?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Were there any volunteers to carry the bill? You know, if there are no volunteers, that means I get to pick. Representative Bellamy, I am sure you would.
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's a privilege we like to share with our new committee members early in the session. Not every bill, however. We'll make
I
sure there's a fair
that.
Distribution. Okay, 2185.
2185 is a bill that was a pre-session filed bill at the request of the Judicial Department. And what it is that the current system is that if funds are deposited with a court during a lawsuit, and a classic example would be a condemnation proceeding, as policy has developed through the years, the court may or may not deposit in an interest-bearing account. This bill would codify current procedure and say that if the funds are under $10,000, they would be placed with the treasurer with the interest accruing there on accruing to the state. If the parties move and it's over $10,000, then the judge would be required to put it in an interest-bearing account, the interest going to the party who eventually prevailed.
Okay, Representative Hanlon, I believe this was your subcommittee which considered this matter. Did you wish to make any additional comments or?
Let me move and then comment. I'll move it with a due-pass recommendation to the floor, 2185.
Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2185 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Representative Hanlon.
The Judicial Department, and I don't know, Bill, whether you said this or not, testified that all this does is codifies existing practice.
That's correct. So in addition, we have a statement from the revenue analysis in which they say that there may be some negative revenue impact, but they really doubt it. They think that possibly more people will be now requesting that money be put in an interest-bearing account.
Representative Bunn?
Is there the likelihood that there are any number of cases that there may be $9,000 or $8,000 that is held by the court for a year or more, and therefore $1,000 maybe of interest money going to the general fund instead of the party involved?
I guess that's a possibility, yes. There were no statistics as to figures, because I don't believe any have been kept. It's been a policy, and I guess it's been handled by the individual courts, if I remember correctly.
Further questions?
Representative Hunt, excuse me.
If I recall the testimony, the testimony of the Judicial Department was with the administrative costs of doing this by the court, that with figures, $10,000 cutoff was administrative versus interest earned about a break-even proposition for the court and the state treasurer.
So, for a question perhaps of the chairman of the subcommittee, the concept then is basically, except for the administrative costs, we want to return this to the party who should earn it. Is that the idea?
That was my understanding of the factual implications of the testimony of the Judicial Department, yes.
Okay, just one further comment. It appears to me that at $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000, it's hard to see how the actual administrative costs of keeping that money in a trust account is going to eat up that much interest. My experience with costs make that highly unlikely.
I don't mean to speak on behalf of the Judicial Department, but I believe I am accurately reflecting the factual basis they put before us. My only additional comment would be that on average, those accounts would be of a much lower amount, and you have to administer for the $1 account as much for the $9,999 account.
Thank you.
Okay, are there further questions on the motion to the floor do pass? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
No.
Dix?
Aye.
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Representative Dix, would you like the honors on this?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Bunn gets to explain to a lot of people his no vote.
No, you probably didn't want to carry it. Next bill up, according to our agenda, is House Bill 2191. Council?
2191 is also a bill filed at the request of the, it's filed at the request of the Justice for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Under this bill, a person is not eligible for driving under the influence of toxicous diversion program if that person has been convicted within 10 years before the date of the commission of the present offense. Evidently, there has been a problem with proving the prior offense, and the problem has existed because oftentimes the records have not been kept beyond a 5 or 6 year period. What this bill would do would require that for driving under the influence offenses that the records be kept for a 10-year period. Thus, if a challenge came to the first conviction, the court and the parties involved would be able to go back and check the record. I think the challenge oftentimes comes to whether the guilty plea was voluntary or not.
Ken, I believe the matter was amended in subcommittee, is that correct?
That's correct. It was amended so that the records would be kept for a period of time by the courts and then turned over to the county. And they would then maintain them for a 10-year period. I think the courts would keep them for about 5 years. Approximately 5 years, and then turn them over to the counties. That was worked out by the parties, too.
And the DAs and the Judicial Department were satisfied with that agreement?
Yes, they worked out the agreement.
Okay, Representative Hanlon?
Move House Bill 2191 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2191 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the amendments were adopted at the subcommittee level. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers? Representative Dix. Okay, next bill, I believe, is House Bill 2091. Counsel?
This is the bill on which would raise the limitations in arbitration in circuit courts up to, from $15,000 up to $25,000. The committee considered amendments from the bar which would have included a requirement that attorneys be paid reasonable fees and would also require the courts to assign a public facility for the arbitration session. The amendments were not adopted. There's no fiscal impact.
Okay. As chair of the subcommittee, I think I can state that the testimony was without contradiction that the arbitration program, which we adopted in '83, has been successful, and they've made progress, and it's the hope of those who testified in favor of not only 2091, but also 2092, which is related to the subject of arbitration, that we allow our courts greater opportunity to make that process available. And there was a point of discussion as it relates to the amendments proposed by the bar in terms of compensation that's provided to those who perform the arbitration services. And I guess our concern in not considering those amendments, although there was kind of a divided issue, and I think strong arguments on both sides, were that this was a matter which we felt the Chief Justice could adopt some guidelines by rule. And we would want to, I guess, defer to the recommendation of the Chief Justice in that area rather than possibly burden the bill with amendments which might have a fiscal impact and might hinder a program which is successful and I think for which a strong case has been made that it ought to be expanded. So, to make a short story long, Representative Bellamy.
I would move House Bill 2091 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bellamy moves House Bill 2091 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll on House Bill 2091.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Glenn?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. I think we'll let the chair carry this bill. Unless there are other volunteers.
Yeah, I'm volunteer.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, we'll save 2092 for the other volunteer. We'll make it kind of a team effort. Okay, House Bill 2092, same general area. Council?
This bill raises the arbitration limits in district court from 3,000 to 10,000. In the 1985 session, the jurisdiction of the district courts was changed. However, the limits of arbitration were not, and this would up it to make it coincide with the $10,000 limit. There were no amendments, and there was no fiscal impact.
Okay, I think the comments that were made earlier by the subcommittee chair are apropos. Apparently, when we dealt with the issue of arbitration in district court jurisdiction last session, inadvertently, or somehow the district court jurisdictional amount was not changed to reflect, at least in arbitration, the new jurisdiction which they have in civil matters. And this is a little bit of a cleanup in that area and also to permit the arbitration program to function effectively in district court where that's appropriate. Representative Bellamy?
Well, Mr. Chair, would you accept a motion on line 9 to, say, increase that to 100,000?
Well, we'd have a problem because district court jurisdiction doesn't go that high.
Well, I was thinking that's what I was doing.
To increase district court jurisdiction?
I figured a round number.
Well, I'd be glad to take the bill back to subcommittee if you'd like to pursue that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Well, Representative Bellamy might want to talk to the circuit judge lobby about that particular motion.
I would find out who it is, wouldn't I?
It might have an impact on a request for circuit court judges. Maybe a very positive impact.
Mr. Chair.
Or the consolidation issue, which I'm told may reach this forum at some point.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bellamy.
House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bellamy moves House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Representative Bellamy, would you like the honors here?
I suppose I could.
Okay. Thank you.
Although Representative Hanlon wanted to do one.
He has deferred. Quite appropriately, I believe, on this issue.
He's a beautiful man.
House Bill 2409. Counsel?
This is known as the Revisers and Oversight Bill. It corrects errors and oversights in the ORSs. There is one set of amendments which corrects some non-substantive errors and oversights noted by the Department of Commerce in the bill draft. The amendment is 2409-1. It's in front of you, and essentially it changes purchaser to salesperson and broker to broker-dealer. There's no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Hanlon?
We need a motion on adopting dash one.
The amendments were adopted in subcommittee, so a motion to the bill as amended would be appropriate.
Oh, okay. I'll move House Bill 2409 to the floor with the due pass, as amended.
Okay. Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2409 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Further discussion? If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Okay, we have a public hearing on Subcommittee 3 that'll be starting a little later. Oh, excuse me. And we're going to come back to 2021 and 2026. In full committee. Do we have a volunteer on 2409?
Not sure.
Representative Hanlon, glad to let you have that opportunity.
We can give that to Phillips, he isn't here.
That's true. Yeah. And he's the one that made the reference to section 48 on page 115, if I recall. I withdraw my request, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll tell you what, we will visit with Representative Phillips, make sure he has no objections to carrying the bill, and that'll be the understanding unless he does have objections. So we'll send this to Representative Phillips. I reward to not be present.
That exciting bill.
It appears that Representative Burton has been delayed a bit. I'd like to take a short recess, maybe until 2:15. I say that with some reluctance because once gone, I know it's hard to get people back. But if you would please try to come back at 2:15.
Is there any one of these that isn't controversial?
Well, I think we're going to have some testimony on both of them. I don't know that controversial is necessarily the issue, but Representative Burton did ask if we could accommodate his request to allow him to be present during the, I think what's going to be some additional testimony as well as the recommendations that we may be discussing. So if we could take a 10-minute recess, hopefully Representative Burton will be able to join us at that time. We'll continue with a full committee on 2021, 2026. When we finish with that, Subcommittee 3 will begin. So we'll be in recess till approximately 2:15. Again, a couple members are excused. Representative Phillips and Representative Miller, we're still trying to track down. I expect them here momentarily, but there are some folks who requested an additional opportunity to testify on both measures, and because we really felt in subcommittee that this discussion would be valuable at the full committee level, we sort of waived our usual practice of not permitting testimony at full committee level in order to accommodate those requests. We have the two measures before us. 2021, let's go ahead and take that first. We have Mr. Stuart Smith. I know that you've testified before the subcommittee. Are there some additional comments you'd like to make today? Are you prepared to respond to questions today?
Well, I'm prepared to respond to questions. So
Okay, why don't we hear from Mr. Besnett and Ms. Henry, who we haven't heard from, see what issues or comments they want to make, and then because I think there may have been some questions, and we do have some written materials which I'll ask counsel to describe in just a few minutes, shared with us. We appreciate your being here today also. Mr. Besnett?
We appreciate you being here, too.
I'm Tom Bessonette. I don't necessarily want to identify the fact that I work for Oregon Mutual Insurance Company because I don't believe my carrier is involved in this type of bill like 2021. But I am always concerned about the legal process because we do deal in the areas of defending some people. And I might say this is the first time in my many, many years that I feel like I don't know what I'm going to say yet. Because I only found out about this bill yesterday, and I'm really concerned about Section 4, and I'll go through just the sections. And I realize this bill is on loan, and this is a mystique to me. I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Well, let me get a copy of House Rule 901.4, or let me ask our counsel to get it. Basically, we've checked with the Chief Clerk's office, and we do not have authority under the Chief Clerk's interpretation of the rule to amend a measure. We may make a recommendation, I guess, to be accompanied by a staff analysis or a letter or some other communication. And basically, that rule states that the chairperson of the committee having jurisdiction of a measure by referral or subsequent referral under this rule may request the chairperson of any other committee, that's us, to review the measure for a period not to exceed 10 calendar days. And today's the 10th day. Upon acceptance of the measure by the chairperson of the reviewing committee, us, and with the consent of the speaker, the reviewing committee may conduct hearings and make recommendations to the original committee, which shall retain jurisdiction over the measure. And as I think everyone knows, it's E&E committee which is going to get this back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for clarity. On page 2, line 1, the phrase more likely than, I guess that's just 51 or 50.001% of a potential causation, which I think is a substantial departure from the normal cause of action and recovery process.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Hamlin. You're in trouble now, I think.
Let me ask the question. It was my understanding that the law in this state is such that more likely than not is generally the causation standard in effect in the courts on civil kinds of actions. Wouldn't that be accurate?
I'm not an attorney, so I will not answer that question, Mr. Hanlon. I say this, that I have referred the bill to several defense attorneys who defend major clients like trucking outfits that might be involved in this and ask for them to come in and share some insights that they might have.
So, Mr. Chair.
I believe so. Representative Hanlon.
So it's your statement that, your factual statement that this is an unusual causation standard in the courts of the state, more likely than not.
Some aspects of it is, yes. And I will go on to explain those, Representative Hamlin. On page 4, bottom of the page, it eliminates the act of God as a defense. I think that's very unusual statutorily. At least I don't ever recall it being in a bill before. Then on page...
Chair, excuse me, Representative Hamlin.
My question didn't relate to the section pertaining to act of God. I was just interested in your statement that more likely than not as a causation standard in the courts of Oregon is unusual. You claim that's an accurate statement.
And I indicated that I could not answer that because I'm not a lawyer.
Is that not the statement you made earlier?
I thought it is unusual, yes.
Oh.
I'm not putting it as a factual presentation, however. It's my opinion. And my opinion has been wrong in the past, and it'll be wrong in the future.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Then on lines 25 through 28, it eliminates the statute of limitation on damages for governmental entities. And as a result of that, I really think that it's my recommendation that the bill be referred back apparently to E&E with a recommendation it comes back to this committee for the legal overview of the ramifications that might be entailed in judicial process. I will, as soon as, if there is any anxiety on behalf of some of these attorneys that do defend people, I will have them contact the committee.
Okay, it's my understanding, Mr. Bessonette, from your comments today in a conversation we had just before the hearing, that you were kind of at a disadvantage because you didn't have enough time to really consult your own lawyers to get their full expression of opinion on these issues. I assume that you will follow this bill down to E&E Committee, and I hope that if you're called upon to express an opinion there in terms of what ought to happen to the bill, that your opinion at that point would be that the bill be re-referred to this committee if you feel it's appropriate.
That would be my recommendation to Representative Springer, and I'm not speaking to the merits of the bill itself. I'm just the aspects that I'm apprehensive about it.
Okay. Well, the statutes that are being amended are ones that we're used to dealing with, for better or for worse. There may have been another question. Let me just inquire first before I excuse you from the witness stand. Were there any further questions?
Just briefly.
Representative Baumann.
Does your insurance company provide any insurance to any nuclear power facility or any trucking company that transports nuclear material?
Chapter 466, which is our chapter that regulates hazardous waste, or go down to the rule level and have it pursuant to Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 340, Division 101. And then as the definition changes at the federal level and we pick up the comparable definition at the state level, we wouldn't have a conflict in who's covered by the immunity provisions.
Let's appreciate that point. Representative Burton.
Well, I'm curious about that. 2,200 pounds, I think, is a long ton or something. And it goes from that of hazardous materials down to 2 pounds or less of acutely hazardous waste. Who picked those? I mean, why were those numbers put in here anyway? Do you have any idea why they, I mean, we said, let's take a long ton and a short pound? And
those are currently the definitions in state law. We're in the process of adopting rules that likely will change those, again, to be consistent with the federal RCRA program.
I don't know why they were picking the first, I mean, how did somebody come up with a number like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burton, EPA originally picked those as numbers below which they did not feel they had staff to provide technical assistance to regulate those materials.
That's very telling, is what I'm thinking.
Okay, sir, I believe that it's my understanding, in part based on a conversation we had a little bit earlier, that, and also based upon a conversation with Peter Green, who is the Interim Task Force Administrator, that I guess perhaps one of the concerns that led to the introduction of this bill was that DEQ just didn't have the resources to provide this kind of assistance upon request to a lot of organizations, some of which may be public agencies, some of which may be private entities, but that you folks are now requesting funds to give you the expertise you need to provide that kind of training and assistance. Could you maybe just take a moment to share with us what the status of that is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as we discussed earlier, the department does have in its governor's recommended budget a decision package which would increase the amount of general funds that the agency would have available to manage the hazardous waste program, as well as to increase the amount of fees we would collect. Those two sums of money would allow us to add an additional 9 FTE, some of which would be devoted specifically to providing assistance to the small quantity generator. As I understand the genesis of this bill, over the last 5 years, say, some of the larger companies in Oregon have been in a position, because of the staff they have, to develop an understanding of the hazardous waste program. They, in turn, are willing to share that knowledge with smaller companies, i.e. small quantity generators, who may not have the staff to understand the complex hazardous waste rules. They apparently have some concern. These companies have some concern if they share this knowledge and inadvertently cause a mistake to be made, that they then could be held liable for having tried to assist these smaller businesses in complying. And the argument is made that in absence of an immunity provision like this, they will be reluctant to share their knowledge with other businesses in Oregon.
Okay. Let me ask, is your department or are your employees, when they're acting in their official capacity, immune from liability if you give advice and it turns out to be wrong or someone is damaged as a result?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding would be our employees are covered by the state's Tort Liability Act, and if we give false information knowingly, then the state is responsible for those, you know, that advice. If we give advice in good faith and it turns out to be wrong, then I understand it may go either way when it goes into court.
You know,
we would not expect to be covered by what you're creating here. We would expect only to be covered by the existing tort liability provisions.
Thank you. Are there, did you want to make some
Well,
comments?
I have two other comments, if I Please. Could, Mr. Chairman, Please. Just so that you have the other two concerns we have. Looking at Section 2, Line 11, there's reference to the term assistance. It's not clear to us, but a form of assistance may be to accept the hazardous waste, for a larger company to accept a small quantity of material from a small quantity generator. Should mismanagement of the waste occur after that acceptance has occurred, we wonder if the way this is written, that company would be immune from having mishandled that material, on the theory that they were just trying to assist this other company in the management of their material. So we merely raise it as a question, and if you also read in there that assistance could mean actually taking waste from another company, then we would have concern about the broad grant of immunity. And then our third concern is in Section 3, Line 17, where the words are used, who receives compensation other than reimbursement for expenses. And we would like it that everybody would have the understanding that a company who's in the business of offering services to manage hazardous waste could not fall within those terms, because again, we could see that if they mismanage the waste, that they could potentially come back and try and claim, well, all we were receiving was reimbursement for our activities. And we don't know where this concept of profit would fall in there, if because they also make a profit on their activities, they would not be eligible, or if they could make a claim that the fact that they make profit, it still falls within this idea that they were merely being reimbursed for their services. We think they should remain liable because they're in the business of providing the service, and they should not be able to become eligible for this broad grant of immunity.
Thank you for those comments. I know that you may not have had enough time to prepare any written comments. If you do, we'd be glad to receive those and forward them along to E&E, and I assume you'll have the opportunity there, if not at some later point here, to help us further in terms of responding to some of those concerns.
We would be pleased to return them to you in written form.
Great. Any further questions? If not, thank you again very much for being available today. Okay, Mr. Hemphill, I believe you also may have suggested some amendments at our earlier hearing, and I guess I would advise you, as I think I did others, that we're not really in a position to make any amendments, the recommendations only. And however, if you'd like to sort of underscore your comments, certainly we want to make sure they're part of the record. We'd be glad to forward those along with the minutes as part of the record to the E&E Committee for their consideration. So if you want to take a couple moments, please feel free.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marion Hemphill. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon PUD Association. I'm very pleased that Mr. Ryder made it to this hearing today, because when I was here previously to discuss my concern about those engaged in the hazardous materials or hazardous material service business being included in this bill, I seemed to be the only one speaking to that issue, and I was very happy to hear Mr. Ryder in his third point today before the committee point up his concern. I also apologize to the committee that I was unable to be here at your hearing on Monday, but my assistant was here and has subsequently worked with counsel, Ms. Weber, to attempt to line out an amendment that specifically addresses our concern. Let me also tell you that I have talked this morning with Jeanette Holman of Legislative Council on the particular amendment that I'm going to present to the full committee. The genesis of our concern is that while we may agree with the members of AOI who were those that were behind this legislation, and we may agree with the overall intent that if a large-scale business that has in-house expertise in the area of hazardous waste materials and handling and disposal voluntarily gives some technical assistance, some technical training, holds a seminar that attempts to educate those that do not have in-house staff, nor probably any staff other than themselves, say a small-scale generator that happens to be a dry cleaner that has been using these materials for years and years and years and suddenly realized that these are classified now and have to be handled in a particular fashion. If, let's say, Tektronix is willing, out of the graciousness of their heart, to give a free seminar, it would be analogous to an attorney who was giving a seminar, let's say, on the Tax Act, and he was before a group of people and saying, I'm going to discuss the Tax Act in general, but I want you to know, and then proceeds into a disclaimer, that this is not specific legal advice, that this is not specific accounting advice, that this is not specifically to your case, and that I implore you to go see your own local attorney or your own accountant to see how this fits with you. But, in general, the rules are following. That kind of umbrella disclaimer, I believe, is what the people that are behind this bill are after. And in that instance, where there is no malicious intent or no intent to mislead the small-scale generator, perhaps we could support the bill. But my concern is the following, is that if a small-scale generator relies upon the specific information that is provided to them by a vendor of hazardous waste materials or equipment that uses hazardous waste or hazardous materials or by a vendor of services that whose services are designed to help people clean up spills or dispose of toxic waste or hazardous materials waste, that the individual who relies on that information is probably liable, yes, but so is the person who provided the information. If you have an individual that comes in who purveys these products, whether the owner of that business buys or doesn't buy that particular product, there is an inherent credibility given to the vendor that this person knows what they're talking about. And if that small businessman then relies on that information and subsequently ends up in a liable situation, that the vendor should not be off the hook in that case. So consequently, I have formulated an amendment which would go into Section 3. And Section 3 begins by saying the immunity provided in Section 2 of this Act shall not apply to any person. And then it has two other provisions there. And I'm proposing to offer a third. And that is, a person who is a vendor of materials or goods which are classified as hazardous materials under state or federal laws, or is a vendor of equipment that uses such materials, or is a vendor of services related to such hazardous materials or hazardous waste disposals or cleanup. That's kind of part one of this amendment. Now, part two of the amendment is the next sentence, and it says, this subsection applies to vendors of such goods, materials, or services regardless of whether compensation is received for such goods, materials, or services. And let me explain. That even though you didn't buy this person's product, he came through the door saying he was an expert, gave you all kinds of good advice. 5 minutes after he leaves, you happen to spill some of this stuff. You didn't buy anything from this person, but he was right there. He had just told you what to do. You did that, relied on that information, and consequently ended up in a liable situation. The person who just gave you that so-called expert advice should not be left off the hook.
Okay, Representative Burton?
Yeah, wait. See if I'm following you here. Rydell Environmental Services is a company in my district that does hazardous cleanup. I've been to exercises with the City of Portland where they've provided their services in a training situation which has been observed by local firefighting and police services, but also has been available to companies in the industrial areas in my district that may in fact be generators of hazardous waste. What you're saying is that if they did that kind of training activity, that they would now be liable under your amendments, and that, my guess is that Rydell would simply stop participating in the training. Is that your intent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Britton, in that particular situation, if they are purveyors of those services, they should be considered experts in that service, and if they give erroneous information that is relied upon by the small businesses within your district, I believe that they should be held liable, or at least partially liable.
Yeah, I guess my guess is that they would simply would stop participating. I think it'd be a real loss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Britton, or charge for the service.
That's very good, Mr. Chairman. They already receive, if you understand how those things work, they already receive a significant amount of federal money, as I think they're one of the only corporations west of the Mississippi, or one of the few that actually is called upon to do that, and they charge one hell of a lot of money to do this. They don't need to have the fees. They do this as, you know, in the case of any training, I think they do that, or they may very well do that as part of their requirements under federal funds that they do receive. I think, would you still, if they were required to do that training under some sort of federal grant authority or federal authority, would they still be liable if they're required to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Britton, I guess in the particular instance that you have chosen to talk about, Rydell International has a good reputation in this business, is the expert, and as a matter of fact, is the cleanup company of choice of the U.S. Coast Guard. I don't believe that this situation would arise with Rydell, although the hypothetical could be applied if you used a different company that didn't have the expertise but had the title somehow. I guess that I am saying that yes, they would.
Representative Burton. I guess the question I got then is given what you just said, does your bill exclude that company? Your bill does not exclude that company, and so even though the incident may not be likely, it still includes them, and they're one of the largest providers of that. Okay,
Mr. Chair, Representative Burton, yes, your point is well taken, and it's a difficult area. We're trying to exempt those with expertise from liability, from those that may not know what they're doing from liability. If they're selling, you see the dilemma that I'm getting into here.
Same one I'm getting into, I guess.
If I may continue, there's a third element of the amendment that I'm suggesting, and that I added only this morning after talking to the people at TEC about their concerns and about why they wanted this bill. And they told me that what they want to be able to do is if a small-scale generator calls up in a panic and says, I've just spilled this stuff on the ground, what do I do? And their tech's concern and some of the other large businesses' concern that do in fact want to help these small-scale generators, they want to say, well, listen, you do the following things to contain it, and then you move your personnel away from it, and then you call DEQ or the nearest response team so they get somebody on site who knows what they're doing about, and they want to be able to say those three things without saying, I'm sorry, I have to call my attorney first, because I have this liability. And so consequently, we crafted, along with TEC this morning, the last sentence in the proposed amendment that I have before you.
When you say TEC, are you talking about Tektronix?
Yes. Yes.
Are they in this kind of business? Why would anyone call them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burton, actually the genesis of this, if I understand correctly, is because Tektronix has been in not the business, but of the practice of giving free advice. If I may, one of the things that the large-scale generators are concerned about is that if they have their act in order, if they know what they're doing, a lot of times what happens is if a situation is caused by a small-scale generator, when someone comes onto site, if the large-scale generator has participated in that site, they are potentially equally as liable as a small-scale generator, and they may have things with their name on it that's in that site that they didn't have anything to do with causing the problem, but since their name is associated with it, that they're brought into the situation. They have a real interest in trying to increase the education level of the small guy so that they don't get drugged into it. So consequently, they have been giving out free advice.
Sure.
I didn't realize until this bill came before us that Tektronix is apparently one or two super hazardous sites in the state of Oregon as far as hazardous materials. The other is the site in Arlington, just because of the nature of their business and their relationship with other similarly situated businesses and trying to provide, I think, as a commercial activity, which is necessary to their business, this kind of help and whatever's related to how you dispose of these kinds of materials.
Yes. So consequently, the last sentence that we added this morning crafted with Mr. Terry McHugh of Tektronix, Hazardous Materials Division, says that, however, in the event that such vendor is providing information in reaction to an emergency request from a small-scale generator, picks up the phone and calls and says, God, what do I do? Due to a hazardous material accident, spill, or event, and such vendor is not on site of such spill, accident, or event, and the information is in the nature of a first response to the accident, spill, or event, then the immunity provided in Section 2 shall apply. In other words, if they get a call that's in an emergency situation, I just had a spill, what do I do? And they respond with those three things. Contain it, get your personnel away from it, call DEQ. They don't want to be held liable. So that's the three elements that I have incorporated into this amendment. Rather than trying to define what voluntarily is or anything else, we just say, hey, listen, the vendors of this material are supposedly experts, and if we rely on them for information, that they're not without liability. That's the purpose of my presentation and the purpose of my proposed amendment.
Thank you. Were there further questions? Mary, I appreciate the efforts that you went through, particularly contacting the other interested parties. Mr. Green had advised me that he was aware that, though it's not indicated perhaps in the minutes or record or on the bill that was introduced, apparently it was AOI as well as Tektronix which had requested the introduction of the bill. And certainly your efforts to include them in the discussion, I think, have been helpful. Were there any other witnesses who wanted to follow up, Mr. Ryder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you would permit me, Richard Ryder again. I would just like to make you aware, as well as Mr. Hemphill, that relative to his last sentence that deals with emergencies, that may already have been taken care of in 1985. I apologize, I don't have the correct ORS citation, but the House bill was House Bill 2838, and it deals specifically with granting immunity if there is a situation of a spill or threatened discharge of hazardous materials. And so you may be creating parallel provisions if you add that. I think his concern is already addressed.
Do we call the chapter number? Is that available?
It's chapter 376.
Do you have the Oregon Laws chapter number?
No, this is all I have with
okay.
me.
Chapter 376 from the 85 session laws. Thank you.
That's correct.
Great. We may want to, as part of our minutes, I think that information would be transmitted down to E&E also.
If I maybe one other thought comes to mind, and that is, again, I think Mr. Hemphill has made a clear distinction for you. As I read the current House Bill 2026, it really broadens the immunity, not to incidents, you know, like spills or releases, but it talks about just general advice for complying with regulations. And from my experience, that's a rather unusual grant of immunity. I mean, it's a in my mind, a whole new concept where you grant immunity to one company who gives another company advice. There was general support in 85 for the spill situation because you're under pressure to make a quick decision, sometimes to protect life, sometimes to protect environment. The situation where you're really just talking about compliance, you know, you're not under the same pressures. And so, again, as long as the committee understands, you're really going into a new arena if you're going to grant this immunity. Again, we're neutral on it, and if you choose to do that, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you again very much to all who have participated in this discussion. It has been helpful. I think, as I indicated earlier, because we don't have nearly enough time to resolve all the issues, what I would propose our recommendation be basically is that the if the legal issues which we've identified so far are retained in either the bills, 2021 or 2026, that when the E&E Committee has made its recommendations, that we ask that they re-refer the bill to the Judiciary Committee for further consideration of those legal issues as they relate to liability and some of the other questions that have been raised. And we would send a copy of our minutes and exhibits without any other comment or recommendation other than as I've stated it. Is there any objection to that recommendation or position, I guess, in light of our work so far? If not, that'll be the action of the committee. And is there any other business to come before the full committee? If not, I don't believe we have any other full committee meetings scheduled for this week, nor do we intend at this point to schedule any other full committee meetings. We will try to give you as much advance notice. If members have a particular day of the week that is better or worse for them for full committee, try to let us know. We'll try to give you as much notice as we can. It kind of depends in part on the workflow of the subcommittees, as well as just how we schedule the workload of the other subcommittees. But
the polling is on Saturday.
Saturday.
I think Representative Miller wants to hold it on Saturday.
After Muppet Babies.
Yeah.
After Muppet Babies.
No, after Red Bull.
Okay. Or the Opus Comedy Hour.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further business to come before the committee? Okay, if not, we'll be adjourned. Subcommittee 3 will reconvene in just a few minutes. Representative Hanlon, is that correct?
We'll adjourn. We'll reconvene immediately.
Okay. Thank you.
Commander Hanlon.
Yeah, like what? What are the choices?
We got money. I know.
Garbage. Do you give us enough time?
No. I can get people.